edition of the Sensitive Skin Podcast. I'm Bernard Meisler, the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine, and I'm your host. And today, we have a very special treat for you. I had a chance to have a conversation with the living legend, the great Jack Hirschman, poet laureate emeritus of San Francisco, author of 100 books, one of the last of the living beats, although he says he's not a beat because he doesn't do the schmoogadoo. I met Jack, of course, at the Cafe Trieste, and then we walked over to his SRO at the Columbus Hotel and had a very interesting conversation. We talked about everything from baseball to Stalin. Jack talked about his early years as an academic, how he was forced out of UCLA for protesting the Vietnam War by giving every man in the class an A, no matter what. He talked about how Jack became a communist, and one of the things I love about him, he's still a fervent communist. No bones, none of this, like, oh, I'm a socialist, I'm a democratic socialist. He says, I'm a communist, and you gotta respect it. We also talked about how Jack fell in love with the poetry of Vladimir Mayakovsky as a teenage student at CCNY, and why he considers Mayakovsky both the father of the beats and of the hip-hop poetry movement. About 48 minutes or so into the podcast, Jack reads us a number of poems, which is great. He's a great not only a great poet, but a great reader. So please stick around for that. He'll read us 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Jack reads us 7 poems. It's awesome. All right, without further ado, here is my conversation with the great Jack Hirschman. So you were saying you're happy your team is winning. Who's your team?
Well, I happen to be a Detroit Tiger fan.
Oh, okay. Is that where you're from, originally?
Well, no, actually, I'm from the Bronx.
Oh, oh.
But I was from the neighborhood where Hank Greenberg was born and raised, grew up. And he was the slugger, and he was a Jewish guy,
right.
And I come from a Jewish family.
Hammering Hank.
Yeah, Hammering Hank. They pushed me to become a Tiger fan, but it wasn't because of Greenberg that I became. It was because of a left-handed pitcher who wasn't Jewish, but it was a great pitcher. They said he was a wartime pitcher. His name was Hal Newhouser.
Oh, yeah.
But he was not a wartime pitcher. I mean, in 47, I believe, he won 27 games. He won a lot of games. Finally got into the Hall of Fame.
And,
but I've always been a Detroit fan since childhood.
Not a Yankees fan.
No, no, I'm not a Yankees fan.
Oh, okay.
No, Yankees go home.
Oh.
was right from the beginning. Although I was at the famous speech, I don't remember, my father told me that there wasn't a dry eye in the house. When Lou Gehrig made his speech, I was in the bleachers.
Oh, wow.
And that was...
That's a historic moment.
Yes, it was, really, And it was. He was very beloved. He was more beloved because he was a New Yorker himself than even Babe Ruth. Even though Ruth, they said, made Yankee Stadium.
Right.
It was really Lou Gehrig
who
was more beloved by New Yorker fans.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm a Yankees fan from childhood. My mom's from the Bronx. So.
Oh, she's on the Bronx.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But that's one of the things I love about baseball is the history. I have to admit, I don't follow so closely these days, but when I was a kid especially, it was like, you know, I know all about Honus Wagner and Ty Cobb and Tony Lazzaretti. What was it? Tony Lazzari, the
Tony
shortstop
Lazzari,
on the 1927 Yankees.
Well, because we live in an age of machination and calculability. And Heidegger was quite right about that. And baseball provides some of those links because of the statistical, the dimension of statistics that relates also to like fathers and sons and the generation, in this generation where even mothers and daughters become involved with it too, because many more women love baseball mm-hmm. than did in the past. Mm-hmm. That's an important part of it. There's a really a historical tradition that goes on there. I always like to quote my favorite quote about a pitcher was Mickey Mantle when he said of Sandy Koufax, "How do you hit a baseball that from the time it leaves the pitcher's arm arrives at your bat as a bean?" Which is the greatest compliment I can think of for a pitcher. Which was true, probably. It was probably the ball turned into a bean before it arrived at the bat.
Yeah.
I mean, he was talking. I think Mickey was talking very accurately.
Yeah, it's also a strange thing, too. It's like I have had a friend who worked as a physical therapist, and he said he worked with a lot of professional athletes. And he said a lot of these guys, they aren't even just like amazing physically or whatever, they're just something freakish about them.
Yes, right? Yes.
So people's like have this eyesight where they can see faster than normal people. Because look, if I stood in front of like, you know, a professional baseball being thrown at 90 miles an hour, yeah. like, you know, like,
of course,
I wouldn't even
of course.
See it. Yeah. So how long did you stay in the Bronx? Did you?
No, I left the Bronx. I went to school at City College in New York, when it was still City College, not City University.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied there. I did my baccalaureate on Finnegan's Wake.
Oh.
And I then got a teaching job at, I married in 1954, and in 55 I got a teaching job at Indiana University, went to do my doctoral, and I also taught, and then taught also at Dartmouth College and at UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
For 11 years I was in the academic world, and I got fired during the American War in Vietnam mm-hmm. for leading my students against the war mm-hmm. at UCLA, and I broke some state laws in part of doing it, and they fired me.
Mm. What were the state laws you broke?
Well, I gave an examination they said was an examination. Everyone saw television, saw the murderous savagery of the American army, of the Vietnamese people, every mm-hmm. night on television.
Right.
Yet in Los Angeles, the paper had the story of the war on page 29. My question for the students was, what's the contradiction between what you see and what you see in the newspapers, mm-hmm. really? That was one of the things I did. And also I gave all eligible men the grade of A uh-huh. and announced to 700 students, all eligible men, because in that war, women weren't.
Right.
Weren't. And I asked, and I said to women, if you don't mind making a sacrifice for your brothers, if you would take the grade of B, since I can't give 700 A's. Well, I said, but if you want the grade of A, by all means, call me. And about 10 women did, and I gave them the grade of A. But most of them did sacrifice themselves so that they were eligible. Because they had been on television that if you got the grade of A, you would, and you were eligible to be drafted, you wouldn't be drafted.
Oh, interesting. So, I mean, I was just a kid back then, but I remember seeing the thing that stands out for me. I remember like my parents watching the news or whatever, and I remember like on Fridays they would say, they would announce the body count. They would say 7 American soldiers were killed and 375 Viet Cong.
Yeah.
I was just like a kid, and I was like, it was horrible, it was the war.
I happen to be old enough now, I'm 85, so I lived through the Second World War. I was 12 years old when mm-hmm. it ended.
Mm-hmm.
But the Vietnam War was the war of my adult years.
Right.
I was fired from UCLA, from the university system. I wasn't a bad teacher.
What were you teaching?
I was teaching English, American, and comparative literature
mm-hmm.
all those years. But basically, I was at home in the world. I was also not at home. And because whether you like it or not, that world is the bourgeois world. And moreover, it's the corporate bourgeois world. That is, corporatism, remember Mussolini said fascism is not the right word is corporatism. We've been living under a fascist society corporate society for two generations already.
Yeah.
This is nothing new.
Right.
So I was not happy in that world, and I never went back to that world. In fact, I only know a couple of people in the academic world today. I really went the whole distance. I went into the street, and I actually became a communist. I worked for the Communist Labor Party, a small party, which began in 1974 until 1992, and I work still with an extension of it, which is not a party, but an organization of people educated in Marxist-Leninism who are trying to develop a party for all people vis-a-vis the fact that we've all been turned into slaves to technology. And what we need is really a communist party that encompasses all of us that way. A difficult job, as you know.
I am not smart enough to know what the answer is to our current situation, but you don't have to be very smart to see that our current situation is pretty fucked up.
Oh, it sure is.
Yeah. And my theory about World War II is that you basically had two opposing sides of white supremacy, right? You had the United States and England, which is total white supremacist countries.
Yes, that's correct.
Right, and as you know, I'm sure, right? So back in the 30s, you were Jewish, you were Italian, you were Irish and Polish. You were not white, right? You were a second-class
citizen.
That's right. So anyway, you had these two white supremacist countries, and one of them said, let's get the communists to help us out, and they did all the work, the heavy lifting, spilled all the blood. And
that's true. That's what happened.
And then it was very, and I mean, the proof is, if you need any more proof, it's like what happened after World War II. We turned on the communists and had the McCarthy hearings, and we brought in all the Nazis, scientists, and Operation Paperclip and all that stuff.
Which, I mean, that war was a horrible war. And I've always said that, you know, of course, people mention it as they could be as a Stalinist, but I'd say what Stalin said, don't you know you can't be a Stalinist? You can only be a Marxist-Leninist. Stalin, however, was the leader of the people that destroyed Hitlerian Nazism. That's why I adhere to Stalin. Apart from the fact that he was also, when a young guy, he was a good poet, and I translated his six poems. He wrote six poems. And he was really like, you would almost say, I mean, sort of absurdist of way, but he was 16, 17 years old. He was like a young Rambo in Georgian and Gruzi language. And I published a little book called Joey. Which is his poems, his six poems, and three of them are really quite good poems.
Right.
You're in my room up here, and you're looking at the poem on the wall. This painting of mine has written in the poem "To the Moon" by Stalin. It's on the wall.
And as he was known in World War II in America, Uncle Joe.
Uncle Joe, indeed.
And now Joe Biden is Uncle Joe.
Yeah.
My, how times have changed. But I was telling you before, like, my recent encounters with late stage capitalism. I'll tell you a quick story. I was renting a car last week. I'd reserved a car, and I go to the clerk and I say, yeah, give him my name, and he says, oh, okay, I see you rented an economy car. That's a Corolla. And I said, fine. And he says, okay. And he taps on his computer, and he said, you know, for an extra $10 a day, I can let you have that sweet pickup truck that's out in the parking lot. It's brand new. And I was, no thanks, I don't want a truck. And then he like taps a little more and says, actually, we're all out of Corollas, so you can have that truck for the same price.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, he's basically trying to like get the extra $10 out of me before he had to give it to me anyway.
Yeah, yeah, right.
You know?
Right.
It just feels like that's the world we live in.
Well, that is the world.
Right? They're trying to squeeze every last drop out of you that they can. So after you left UCLA...
I've been in the street for all of this time, mostly since 72 in San Francisco.
Okay.
And I've published more than 100 books of poetry, and about 50 of them, 45, 50 of them are translations from nine languages. I translate mainly poets who belong or are sympathetic to the communist movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes from everyone who's well-known, like Neruda, Pasolini, but then others who are not so well-known, who are very important poets in Italian, Ferruccio Brugnaro, Rocco Scotolaro, the first socialist mayor of Italy after the Second World War, a great poet. And poets from Albania, Greece, Yiddish, the Hirsch Glick, the one who wrote the partisan anthem of the Jews in the Second World War, Zagnit Kemno. It's a tremendous song.
Uh-huh.
And he died, but the Nazis killed him when he was like 24 years old. He wrote it when he was 19.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody sang it in those days.
Uh-huh.
So they still, I think, sing it. In Israel, I think it's still sung by those who are not Zionists, because he was not a Zionist. He started out with the Zionism when it was communist,
mm-hmm.
but then it broke away and became a really right-wing nationalist movement.
Yeah. When do you think that happened?
It happened over a certain period of time, but I've spoken with Jews who lived in Israel. They said even in the 30s, it was already that way.
Uh-huh.
Even before the so-called independence of Israel.
Oh, okay.
And they saw it. These people are, you know, people are very narrow in their perception. There's a difference between a Jew and a Zionist.
Of course, yeah. Yeah.
That's what we must really begin to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Zionism is a nationalist movement. It's a nationalist movement like the stupidity that we have as a president who speaks of himself as a nationalist.
Right.
You know, and wants to fulfill all the bad, what you mentioned, the white supremacist dreams, because they're threatened. They're threatened by people who are a little tone color,
mm-hmm.
or blacks. They're mm-hmm. threatened by
right,
it.
Right.
That stupidity, that insensitive stupidity, mm-hmm. that goes on that way.
So is there such a thing as a left-wing Zionist still?
They are left-wing Zionists,
right,
yes.
Right.
They
communist
probably belong
Zionist.
To... there's an interesting book by a guy who speaks of the ones that are trying to subterfuge the Jewish state. goes back to the messianic of Sabbati Tzvi in the 17th century,
mm-hmm.
who declared himself the Messiah,
was
arrested by the Sultan and demanded that he convert or not. And many people believed his conversion was actually part of this scheme, almost a Kabbalistic scheme, to enter the world of evil, the other side, as it
right.
were.
And still, don't the Hasidic Jews still think he's the Messiah? Don't they still?
No, know that. I think there's a recent one that they came up with.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
Schierson.
Yeah. I think there's one sect that still thought that he was the Messiah.
But, yeah,
you know.
Yeah. But I happen to be very sympathetic for another reason, because his conversion, in quotes, was a foreshadow of the struggle of the Palestinian people, and
right.
that's the way I see it.
Right. Yeah.
So that's within the Jewish terms, that he was a real rebel. He was a Kabbalistic leader,
mm-hmm.
actually.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the interesting analog, that the Palestinians are the new Jews, or I heard somebody say that...
they are the Jews.
They
are the Jews in this situation.
Genetically identical to,
yes,
you know...
Yes, right.
The, yeah,
and anti-Semitism is also involved with hatred of Palestinians,
yeah.
because they're Semitic people too.
Right, right. Right, and then the other analog, I've heard people say that, you know, the Muslims in America are the new Jews, but I think a better comparison is the Muslims are the new Italians,
right?
Because Italians. Yeah. What do you mean they're too Italian?
Well, think about the 1920s, right? People these people belong to this weird religion. They're Papists.
They owe their religion. They were the anarchists.
Sacco and Vanzetti. And they're anarchists, and they're planting bombs and terrorists, right?
It's interesting that.
And also because there were a lot more of them than there were ever Jews, and they kind of had their own country and their own. Yeah. Anyway, interesting times we're living in to see.
Indeed.
Yeah. The old Chinese curse, I guess. But. So, what made you move to San Francisco?
Well, that was involved with personal, ultimately, of another woman, and mm-hmm. after my marriage broke up.
Uh-huh.
Who suggested I might like San Francisco, and I did have friends. I'd been a friend of David Meltzer, and when I was living in Venice, California, we were corresponding, and David, via the Zephyr Yetzirah, a proto book of Kabbalism.
Mm-hmm.
David was up here, and he was a good friend, and so I came up here and settled down, lived in San Francisco, first with a wonderful artist and a poet also, but a really fine woodblock artist, Kristen Vedhan, and then afterwards with Sarah Menifee, a poet, and today one of the best poets writing about the situation of homeless people in the streets. She's a great activist for the homeless. And then finally in 1999 I married a woman I'd met in England first, Agneta Falk, who is originally Swedish,
mm-hmm.
and we've lived together since 1999, and she's a poet also, and a painter as well.
Yeah. So how did you fall into the beat scene here?
I've never written the beat scene.
Oh, really?
I think people
consider you a beat.
I know. Yeah. Why do they consider me a beat? In the same kind of, if I may say, gutless way, even though they know that I was a communist and I worked for the Communist Labor Party, it's denied all the time.
Hmm.
Americans deny it. They deny it. The Beat Movement was basically a movement created by people who have come from the petty bourgeois.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were academic. They went to Columbia University. They were in the academic world at mm-hmm. the beginning, and some of them really ended up in that. I mean, Alan finished in the academic world.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, I was close to them. I saw them as the opening. They were indeed a catalyzed opening of poetic voice in the 50s, late 50s, when I was teaching at in the Indiana University,
mm-hmm.
studying for my doctorate. But I was always, in a way, a little bit like Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Because of the PhD we both had, maybe I wasn't in this country a lot. Indeed, my first loves were Dylan Thomas. I was at this last poetry reading in New York at City College, and my baccalaureate was on Finnegan's Wake. I was much closer to the European world, that Welsh and Irish world. Mm-hmm. They were the influences on me. Mm-hmm. At the same time, my first book is called The Correspondence of Americans. And so there was that, there were contradictions there. But I never saw myself, and also I wasn't a dope smoker.
Mm-hmm.
The Beats is something that was charged or fired up by Schmoogadoo, mm-hmm. My Name for Marijuana.
Right.
Schmoogadoo, that's what they, and finally they achieved it now in this year. This year, in California at any rate,
yeah,
the Beats triumphed.
Yeah.
It's legal now.
Yeah.
You see?
I never thought I'd see the day.
But. Yeah. But that's really what, and I was not that, I did not smoke that stuff
right.
for 45 years. Mm-hmm. So I belonged, in a way, inside and out of it.
Okay. Yeah. So what was it like, though? Was there a big reverberation when you were teaching in Indiana, when, like, Howl came out? Or did you hear about that right away?
Well, it came when I was teaching in Indiana, it came out. But I did not have the Ether Coast thing on it. Mm-hmm. I was in the middle of Indiana, and I didn't really feel that way. Mm-hmm. When I went to teach from Indiana, I went to teach at Dartmouth, and one of my students was influenced by Kerouac. And indeed, when I got to UCLA, I taught Kerouac, the first book, but then realized during the Vietnam War that Kerouac, his position.
Right.
And I never taught his work again, and I never even looked at it again.
Right, he became a right-winger.
He was really a right-winger.
Yeah.
Not untypically like many people from other countries. Remember, he come from a Canadian family of French-Canadians. Many immigrants take up the position in the United States. For example, after 2-1-1, my daughter was living in New York, and I said, we went to New York, and there were all these flags, American flags outside windows in Lower East Side in Greenwich Village. What was that? She said, these are folks from other countries who...
I'll tell you a funny story. I haven't thought about this in a while. You just reminded me. So 9/11, we were living in the Lower East Side, Jamie and I, and our oldest daughter, Daisy, was 4, right? And so she was going to preschool, and I remember her, you know, taking her in her stroller still.
Yes.
And... going by and seeing all the American flags draped over LA, and she said, Dad, when did New York become part of America?
Oh, but that's also what you and Jenny also taught your daughter.
Yeah, I guess, but you know, somehow realized New York.
But you know, and this is very important, it seems. You realize that, don't forget, ever, Wall Street is in New York. New York is the capital of capitalism.
Right.
It really is. And now it has a president from New York.
Right.
And he's also, if for want of a better word, rather than Mussolini's old thing, I'll say he's a fascist.
Right.
That's what he is.
But what's interesting about Trump, though, is that even though he's from New York, he's not part of that scene. And he was never let into that scene.
No.
He's like the social climber from Queens.
That's right.
Right? Those people hate him, like the Wall Street people, even though they're like, whatever, he's doing what we like right now, so
yes,
we'll leave him alone. But,
yes, of course.
You know, yeah.
He does because people should recognize a lot of that what goes on, the yes part that you say to Jim, mm-hmm, is your submission to the fact that in this country money is religion.
Right. Yeah.
And he's a billionaire or whatever.
Or says he is, anyway. Yeah.
And that's what causes that submission. It's grotesque.
Yeah. But I also heard, I heard this a few years ago, the guy, do you know Grover Norquist? He's some awful Republican.
He runs
the Club for Growth. Some awful thing that wants to like lower taxes and lower, you know, social services. That's like their whole shtick. But he said a few years ago, the perfect president for the Republican Party, perfect setup for us would be if we had the House and the Senate, and then a president who was just barely sentient enough to like sign his name on the bills that we sent him. So, you know. That's why they're happy with them.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, it's the perfect dupe for them. And then, of course, when all the shit comes down, as it will, they can all blame it on him.
But you also understand the real tragedy of the recent election is that his attacks on the Democrats drove many people to vote for Democrats because of the attacks. And therefore, an alternative party was completely negated. It was disappeared in the election. The great tragedy of the last election is that the capitalist party won. Because that's who they are, both of them.
Right.
Don't kid yourself.
No, I mean, that's, I've been saying that for
years. They are both the capitalist
party. We have a one-party system in this country. We have two wings. As far as, like, there ever being a third, viable third party, it's a tough road to hoe. It's, you know, maybe.
If Sanders had broken, but he wouldn't, and he won't.
Yeah.
He is someone who is really in the Democratic. When he was the mayor of that town in Vermont,
Burlington,
he was against the third party.
Oh, okay.
He was against third party candidates because he's a Democrat, but he belongs, that is, to the capitalist party.
Right. Well, what about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?
Well, she's a communist, ostensibly. I'd say to say I'm a communist.
I
think she is a communist. So she's working inside. You see how far she goes in there.
Right.
I mean,
right now she seems pretty pure, right?
Yes, yeah? Right. She's young and pure, and she's from the Bronx.
Yeah. And we'll see how long it lasts, I guess. Yeah. But again, she's like my daughter, my youngest daughter who's into politics, idolizes her. And
really?
So I think that that's probably a more practical way for things to work out. Like what happened in the Republican Party, taken over by the right-wing nuts, the Tea Party, if we see like a socialist wing of the Democratic Party actually take some, you know, accrue some power.
Right.
Which I think could happen with,
it could,
with her
it's
and
an
Bernie
element
or whatever.
It could. Yeah. I have doubts about it. But
well, yeah, this good reason, with good reason and not a great track record. Yeah. It's funny. I read the Philip Roth book, I Married a Communist. Did you read that one?
No, I don't know his work.
Oh, he's really...
I've heard he's very good.
I started reading him, really, I kind of avoided him my whole life, and I started reading him like when he died about a year and a half ago, and some people recommended his books. But anyway, there's some scenes where the guy's like, he's a communist and he's, you know, into unions and workers and whatever. And there's like, he's having these big arguments. It sounds like it could just have happened yesterday. He's like screaming at his liberal friends who are telling him, you know, to vote for Truman. You know, he's like, the Democrats, they've never done anything for us. They've never done anything for workers. It's all a big sham. And
so, how true.
Yeah. So what are you working on these days?
Well, I'm working on the fourth Arcanes. In 2006, I published 1,000 pages, published in the American language, published in Italy, the Casa della Poesia and Multimedia Edizione. Mm-hmm. They published it, not because they've already published 22 arcanes and they were longer poems in two bilingual editions. But my translator, Rafael Mazzano, said, Jack, I'd love to translate all of your arcanes, but I don't have that many lives. So we're only going to publish it in the American language. Mm-hmm. It's virtually 1,000 pages long. Matt Gonzalez, who ran for the presidency under Ralph Nader, is my bibliographer. Matt is not merely a wonderful artist, he's also graduated from Columbia University in comparative literature. So he's my bibliographer. Mm-hmm. And in 2016, the second Arcanes, another virtually 1,000 pages of Arcane. The third one is going to come out probably this year. I've sent it to them already.
Okay.
And I'm working on the fourth Arcanes. And I'll read in just a bit. I'll read a couple of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when do you like to write? What's your
No,
process?
I don't have an agenda.
What's that?
I don't have an agenda. It can happen anywhere.
Can happen anywhere.
At any time.
Okay.
But at this room that I have for writing, and then I work at home also as well. Mm-hmm. I don't have a computer in here, but I'm thinking maybe of bringing one back in. Yeah, I had one. To work here more steadily here at the computer. I like also to write by hand, so I do a lot of handwriting here.
Okay. What kind of computer do you use?
Just
a Mac or a PC?
I think it's a Mac, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah. It's a good thing. Yeah, it's... I don't even know where to start with start about that stuff, talking about technology and computers and what it's doing to
well, it's
to
very
our brains.
Important in a way. I
yeah.
should know much more. You know, it's tough to surrender yourself as a slave so completely. You've got a part of you needs to stand away. You got to say yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
to it at the same time. It's very difficult.
Yeah. I feel somewhat hypocritical because here we are doing a podcast,
exactly.
right? That we're
going to
put
of
on the
course.
Internet. So, you know.
And this is the contradiction of communication at this time.
Mm-hmm. But, okay, you know, it's funny. Another quick story is that Jenny, it's funny, for whatever reason, Jenny's always making friends with Russian people, right? And
lovely.
She's got the Mayakovsky thing that she's, you know, but she's
wonderful translation she did.
Yeah, Mayakovsky, Maximum
wonderful,
Access.
Wonderful.
I'll plug it right now.
Yeah.
But she's also friends with the Russian Chamber Orchestra, for some reason, in Marin County, and she works with them, and they put on concerts every couple of weeks or whatever. And anyway, the director is this man named Alexander. I can't remember his last name, but, you know, he's lived in the Soviet Union until he was about 40 and
yes.
came over here in the 90s. And he basically said, he says, yes, America is like a gulag, except with better food.
Just by way of that, I'll tell you the saddest story I know in newspapers. I was in Italy, and I read a story in El Manifesto, the newspaper of the left, the communist newspaper. Mm-hmm. This was some years ago, I think in 1994, 95, that the Red Army chorus sang in Cardiff or Swansea, Wales, and made 32 pounds singing in front of a McDonald's.
Hmm.
That to me was the most tragic story, hmm. culturally speaking, that I can recall.
Mm.
That incredible chorus,
mm-hmm.
that unbelievable army of sounds. Mamma mia.
Mm.
How sad.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. So we mentioned the Mayakovsky book. What is it? When did you discover Mayakovsky or become a fan of his?
Well, talk about the beats. If you have it, I'll let you have it now.
Okay.
Buddy. Mayakovsky was the father of the beat generation. The Russian futurists preceded these beats. Back in 1913, 12, 13, 14, Mayakovsky, Kuchonik, who created Zaum, strange sound word poems.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had the women, too, were involved, which
mm-hmm.
I can
mm-hmm.
say more specifically in Russia than were the women, beat women
yeah.
here in the States.
That's true. Anna Akhmatova.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Well, she was an early part of it. They were the real beats, and Mayakovsky, I found, when I was a student at CCNY, I discovered one day his poems. You have to understand, he's been basically censored, even though there were a couple or three biographies of his in English. He has been censored like people don't even know who he is, the way things in the Soviet Union were censored.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it was. This country hated communism.
Mm-hmm.
It wanted to censor anything that had to do with communism. It did, and it succeeded culturally.
Right.
It succeeded. In the same way that, to give it a comparative example, there was a book called Chronicle in Stone, created by Ismail Kadare, the Albanian writer, a novel, and it's of the Second World War. And I read the review in The Nation, which is a very anti-Soviet
mm-hmm, of course.
Newspaper,
yeah.
and how grudgingly, because Kadare, even though he had gone to France by that time, Kadare belonged to that Albanian revolution, which was pro-Soviet and even pro-Stalinist.
Is that Qatari, like Qatari and Deleuze?
No, K-A-D-A-R-E.
Oh, okay.
He lives in Paris now.
Okay.
And he's an excellent writer, but he wrote also works under the communist regime,
mm-hmm.
and then broke with it. But just bringing back to Mayakovsky also was the first hip-hop poet. I'm talking about rhymes here
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
Mayakovsky's complex rhymes were really what later on, in starting in the Bronx in 77, with blacks and Latinos, made up these incredible rhymes that is the last generation has been the major thing in poetry in the world. I mean, the migration into every country of hip-hop poetry,
mm-hmm.
that's been the... It's not been wanted to be told because it was grabbed early on by commercial things, but that's been the motion, spoken word motion,
mm-hmm.
all over the world.
Right.
So that, for example, say 15 years ago, 12, 15 years ago, we were giving a reading in Italy, my wife Aggie and I and others, put on by Sergio Gulli, my publisher in Salerno, at the University of Salerno. We went into where we were holding it was in the Commons building where people ate and, you mm-hmm. know, and we walked in on a hip-hop. This is the hip-hop
yeah.
for the students.
Yeah.
This is 15 years ago.
Yeah.
They already had grabbed on to the exciting rhymes and the contemporary, almost journalistic texture
yeah.
of a lot of that stuff.
But so there you go, Mayakovsky, the father of hip-hop, right?
Yes, yeah. Mayakovsky yeah. is also there.
Yeah, and for our listeners, too, it's like if you can search for Mayakovsky on YouTube and you can hear some recordings.
Well, tell him, and you can also Maximum Access. That's Jenny's
trailer. Yeah, yeah, but...
I mean, I'm plugging you, yeah, but she did a great job.
Yeah.
I translated a book that was published called Electric Iron, published in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difficult book to get, but you can get it if you look up Electric Iron. But also Maximum Access, Jenny mm-hmm. Wade is the translator.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, too, it's like if you actually listen, you can find recordings of Mayakovsky online, and you hear his cadence.
Yes.
And it's very much the sound, da-da-da-da.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
And also, Mayakovsky, to this day, all of his work hasn't been mm-hmm. published in the English language.
Mm-hmm.
In Italy, there are 9 volumes of his work. Published.
Interesting.
In other countries too.
Yeah, there's not a lot of his books in print.
No,
which
that's
is
really
why
true.
You have to get Mayakovsky Maximum Access.
And he wrote one of the great epic poems of the 20th century. They don't even know that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Lenin is the title of the poem.
Uh huh.
And it's an epic poem.
Mm-hmm.
What Mayakovsky wrote.
And I believe he's still not that popular even in Russia today.
This is another thing, buddy. You've been affected by the American thing. 135,000 people went to his funeral, which was huge, in Moscow when he died in 1930. He killed himself.
Right.
He was very beloved. He was very beloved.
Well, I mean, at that time, I'm talking about now. Like,
oh, but now, yes. Yeah. Well, because it's true. Yeah, people like Rozhestvensky was a great influence. And even though they were not the same, but Brodsky, I saw Brodsky perform, and he also was in that mode of, mm-hmm. of Mayakovsky publicly.
Uh-huh.
And so was Rozhestvensky.
Uh-huh. But I don't know. I mean, I've spoken to some Russian people and told them, oh, yeah, my wife's doing this book on Mayakovsky. And they're like, yeah, he's okay, but I really like Isinin. You know, they're still into
because he's easier to like because he doesn't make a demand on modernity.
Right.
That Mayakovsky
right,
makes.
Right.
Mayakovsky makes a demand for modernity.
Right. He was writing about technology and electricity.
Yes. And
he's seen writing about birch
is more
trees
acceptable in the extension 19th century. 20th century peasant life.
Right. Yeah. Which he, you know. what's the word? But anyway, they like that still.
Oh yes, I know a lot of people.
The snow on the fields and the birch trees and you know.
Yes, exactly. And I'm saying he was really he was the father of, and that whole futurist gang,
right?
That were Khlebnikov, mm-hmm. Kuchonik, Kaminsky.
Right.
They're all
Mandelstam.
I mean, they were into concrete poems and visual poems back in 1913-15.
Right, right.
They already did it. Most of the things in modern art were done also.
Right.
I mean, even into the installation.
Right.
Malevich. They were all there already right. there.
Black square.
In a
right?
way, it's the 20th like century has to be noted culturally for the censorship exclusion of the Soviet Union. And then they made it at the Soviet Union under Stalin that everyone painted these realistic, how do you call them? Well, realistic paintings that look like 19th century drawing room.
Naturalism. Yeah.
But people, there was really, in 1930-31, the Aroniad, written by Alexei Kruchonik, which I translated, it begins with, "You have a big heart like a young Red Army soldier." That's mm-hmm. the opening line of that poem. Mm-hmm. And it's based on a jazz poem. It was inspired by a jazz poem called Chiquita. I'm not joking. They were way into that stuff. They were doing that kind of stuff early on.
Yeah. I mean, and there was also like a real big cross current too, obviously, between the Russians. So many Russians went to Paris, and there was Isadora Duncan and
indeed, I don't mean to extend it. My first book, which was hand published in North Beach, right after I got here, it's called Tadek on Ulitz, which is Cockroach Street, and the cover is written in the typographic style of Ilya Zdanievich, who was a Dadaist, who Kuchonik met in Georgia, Tbilisi, when he left Russia to go to Georgia in 1920-21, and he worked with Ilya, who now was a friend, who went up to Paris, was a friend of Picasso, and did work with Picasso. Mm-hmm. His name is, and they had a big show of his at the Museum of Modern Art in New York some years ago. Iliad, I-L-I-A-Z-D, Iliad, but it's really Ilya Zdanievich. Mm-hmm. He abbreviated his name. And he used a typographic style, which I find the most accurate, evocative, passional typography, like a visual Kabbalism. Mm-hmm. In other words, take the word invisible, but make a big I, and then NV, and then another big I, and then S. In other words, you make the visual, the word itself becomes like a visual Kabbalism to your eye, and mm-hmm. it evokes different words even.
Right,
to
right.
It.
Well, I mean,
really extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, I love that, just the graphic design of the Rodchenko stuff.
Oh, that's wonderful stuff.
Yeah. Do you want to read us some poems?
Sure, I'll read you a couple.
All right.
This is a signature poem. Path. Go to your broken heart. If you think you don't have one, get one. To get one, be sincere. Learn sincerity of intent by letting life enter, because you're helpless really to do otherwise. Even as you try escaping, let it take you and tear you open, like a letter sent, like a sentence inside you've waited for all your life, though you've committed nothing. Let it send you up. Let it break you, heart. Brokenheartedness is the beginning of all real reception. The ear of humility hears beyond the gates. See the gates opening. Feel your hands going akimbo on your hips. Your mouth opening like a womb, giving birth to your voice for the first time, go singing, whirling into the glory of being ecstatically simple. Write the poem. And then here's one. The World Without Walls Arcane. One. Let's start with the monstrosity of insensitivity that's already taken hundreds, if not thousands, of children from their loving parents to satisfy a bigoted base whose heads belong in toilet bowls and whose narrowness of mind and inherent violence are the root that long ago migrated to Mexico and Guatemala and El Salvador, grew the poison ivy that tempts the poor to want to pluck it, work for the money, because there's simply none where they live, and gangs, like in the cellars of New York, are everywhere frightening the kids, and abuelos and abuelas too, so you have to try and come north, try to get some job for your family somehow, and even if they won't let you in, make a run for it and stay and say nothing, just work the fields or deliver on some street and pray all the time, pray too. And then there's that wailing one that so needs to be collapsed so that Israelis and Palestinians can embrace each other as a single congregation and put Holocaust and Nakba together as a vow of never letting either happen again. And though that's not the main target in my sight, mine's another wall, the wall of the street, the one that's made of the bricks slammed into the faces of my brother and sister so that they bleed from exploitation. Yes, the Wall Street, with its ringing bells of death, its applause of ghastly and ghostly trumpery, lies of billionaire mendacity, the death that fills you up, sticks its finger in your hole, belongs to money, honey, that's out for your soul, wants you belonging to the schlong of your shut up and suck, wants you fucked, completely ring, rang, rung, up the scale of how much, the deal of howdy-doody, I'm a bum, and your street of wall, the Wall Street, where I put a gun in your hand, go, kill yourself, W.S., have done with yourself. We won't blink twice, O capital of capitalism, O New York. You'll be better off. You'll be the sound sorrow makes when it's free of sorrow, when all the stocks and profits take a nosedive and a glorious good riddance comes up dripping wet and clean, when the end of everything turns out to begin the new way without deals or doles. So come on, bro. Let me put my arm around your shoulder. Come here, sister. Let me hold you around your waist. And let's all get together, sing the song of revolution as it's most natural to want all walls tumbling down. And between you and me and he and she, there be but the clarity that gives to each of us the truth that nationalism nothings. And to be is to be driven internationally. And here's, how about this one? The All of You Arcane, one. For Agneta Falk. The all you are, the all you are to me. You are, originarily, the you who wakens to feed, to listen to those who call on the phone as you muffin make, as you coffee and bring to my lips those fine tastes, and sit and gaze out the window at the bay, which speaks, scapes to your fingers, and moves them to start to epiphanize in paint or watercolors, making seascapes that manifest beauty's glow and the essence of water, horizon, and sky to grace a wall of small masterpieces. Two. It's as if when you're the bluest blue that can be, you want me to forget you completely because you've gone to a point inside yourself so dark and deep with some strain of a Chanda profound, as if you were the only one in the world who'd neglected the bone of word in the mouth of expression, and your tongue, which is the language of a kiss, no longer dare speak its infinites. And yet how you throw yourself wide open-armed into birthdays, as if ancient communities were buried in each one and needed to be reborn. And with deep embrace, you breathe the tulips into kisses many. And so natural are the strains of kindness that flow graciously from you. It was that kindness that first drew me to your sensuous palms, that made me want to know the inside of your mouth. And so it's been all these years our breaths have managed to ménage à toi with simplicity. You know my name is anything you want to call me. Yours, Ruff de Gras, long live woman. Now let's die together, not wait an instant more. Let's wear each other around the other's neck like the sign of infinity. Let's. The Tears of Hate Arcade, in memory of Roddy Edmonds and Heather Haya. 1. My tears last night, seeing my brothers and sisters in G.I. Jews, were not only theirs shed 73 years ago outside liberated Nazi concentration camps. My uncles, Burrow, Meyer, and Nathan, my cousins, Sonny, and Seymour, among the liberators, were tears of sorrow and of joy, and as the soldier rabbi said, tears of hate as well, after beholding the pits of masses of bones, eye-socketless faces, the ovens with still smoldering skeletons. My brothers and sisters, 500,000 of Jewish origin, who'd fought as G.I. Joes, finally, as if they'd had any doubts before, understood what the war was all about, what they were fighting, and 2, you'd be closing down the doors of your mind if you didn't recognize those Nazis marching in Charlottesville, Virginia, shouting, Jews will not replace us, already are envisioning those ovens and mass pits here in the USA. And those tears of hate on my part contain the urgent warning that the arrogant thug president, like any Nazi, has neither doctrine nor principle, only lies, domination by division, and violence. And if allowed to continue nourishing his bigoted base, what Sinclair Lewis meant when he wrote, it can't happen here, not only will happen, but has happened. So get off the numbskulls you've been warming your asses on, brothers and sisters. In this war, as Roddy Edmonds, Protestant from Oklahoma, who captured Captain G.I. Joes imprisoned in a Nazi camp near the end of the war, when the Nazi commander demanded that all the Jews in the company line up the next morning, had the whole company line up and said, we're all Jews. Because in this war, if you think anything different, and that includes the color of your skin, you can be certain Nazism's winning. I'll read 2 more, okay? Emergence. I came out of it knowing I had to learn death by heart. You showed me the lines in my very own brow. I was never very good at reading by heart. I need to have a score in my hand, because I see now it was too much for me to memorize death with a big open breath. I needed to bend and bow. I needed to run my tongue along the ground of the here and now and taste my son who died before he could know he'd be delivered in the form of a letter written in ink invisible to everyone but me and embrace me as I lift my eyes and raise my voice and say, I saw you there. It was impossible not to recognize you, and I embrace you in return. And finally, I'll read the Mother Arcade. We are not in this world. A long time ago it happened, it was over. The world, the war, the world war. I took you by the hand to it. Tiniest hand, tiniest star. You didn't move. Then I was dead. Then you were dead. In the open mouth of grief, there is a candle. I am not with my breath. I am the slow peeling away of the skin, and all the deaths I've seen registers in my eyes. I have been a laughing tree beside a stove of honeyed bananas. I have been a silver fox and the elegance of heels. I have been what has brought you down and the words you look up. I have been the spit upon and the ganged, the slain and the invincible, the bitch of moons, the whiplash of compassion behind the drug of sluts, the red thread that liberates all convicts, the thimble that balances your jiggers, the kalimba that wraps your nightmares in lullabies, the power of birth when a child dies. We are not in this world. A long time ago it happened, it was over. The world, the war, the world war. I took you by the hand through it. Tiniest hand, tiniest star. Why should I weep now, now that you've ended the darkness? Many like me are around you. Our ether is without end. Should we never speak again, you shall write our conversation. Should my voice fall short of your heart, but that is impossible. You're still such a child. I'm weeping at a window. Other voices will lift mine and carry it to the center of your breathing. Oh, my beloved, when you burst into flames, when your bones were blistered, at those precise moments, who drove the seeds in a rapid torrent of thighs and targeted the yearning eggs with glory? When you grew like a primer into a text of rage at all the injustice of this profiteering hell, when your mind was broken, when your sex was split like Korea, Vietnam, like the North and South, when poisons came with pleasure and the antidote was dead, who cut through the air as if wringing a chicken's neck? Who tore the feathers and flung them to cushion your fall? I am the creature who runs through the streets screaming your name against the mockery. I am the sleep of the suicide and the cataract of immemorial hair. I am the attack of liberty on the heart of heart, and the poem on the heart of hearing, the solitude, the grace, the smile that returns your smile from the depths of the biology of labor and joy. Only the heartbeats of the dithyram approach, only the soul thrums of the cosmos define. We are not in this world. A long time ago it happened, it was over. The world, the war, the world war. I took you by the hand through it. Tiniest hand, tiniest star.
All right. Thanks, man. That's fantastic. I love it.
Do you want me to read one more?
Sure. Go for it.
Well, I'll read the end of the Mayakovsky one, because talked about her.
Yeah.
So I'll just read that one from Mayakovsky.
Okay.
Vladimir Mayakovsky. You, thunderer and swirl of the flag of blood and roses, kneader of the bread of poem, deathless comrade of dithyram and liberty, you who suicided life I carry as a forge, who first strode the street of this century, I, you were the first, singing through the slum of trash and the molecules chained to a thousand yesterdays, wiper of the gravy of history from the mouth of obese lies, servant of revolution, you who among men stormed the pallid lips of neutrality and apathy not as a stud of craven doom, not as semblable, but as a thrust and momentum of mass and energy, announcing the towering totems of humanity freed from the hut. You Russian, more American than English, you Sabbath destroyer and leveler of trumpery and religious double talk, I've plucked the bullet so many times from your brain, I could feed 100 armed struggles with your dream.
That's great. I'll tell you one thing, too. So you first contacted us, like, last summer, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah? And then you sent us that poem, and Jenny read it. She's like, oh, wow, okay. He gets Mayakovsky.
Oh, well.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Jack.
Okay,
it's been great talking to you.
I can't save you.